is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime, 9 o'clock horses, episode 6. I had been accepted to the London Academy of Dramatic Art when it became clear that it was not going to happen. I had to get a job. Mother said, "Dreams are great, but you have to earn a living. Acting won't do that, will it?" I went into my bedroom and wept. There was no way I could live in London and afford the horrendous costs associated with the academy. My father suggested that if I really wanted to do that, I should work in a factory where I could earn a lot of money and save it. But after 6 months wiring jigs for radar screens, I was bored to tears with the repetition of it all and the depressing thought that this could be my life from now on. I discussed my situation with Colin one weekend, and he suggested that I could of course go to evening classes at the Pittman Secretarial College in Leicester. And it seemed like a good suggestion, but I had to give up the radio drama and most of the other stage events that had at one time been so important to me. Now it was a matter of earning money. As my mother had said, "You'll be married before long, supported with a husband. Why worry about a career? Just earn enough money to get on by then," I had added, "and to pay my room and board of £2.10 a week." Colin had almost finished his apprenticeship in London, and when he was home for a weekend, now and then, I went to Foxby to stay with my aunt for the night. Usually Colin and I went for walks along the canal to watch the ducks and wildlife along the bank. What I was not prepared for was the fact that Colin now was becoming more attentive sexually. I cannot say that he pushed himself upon me, but it was obvious by the way he kissed me. I noticed his attitude and the way he looked at other girls was changing. I was determined to remain a virgin until we married, and I told him so. But I could see he was pulling away from me, and when I talked to Pauline about it, she said I was right not to give in until I had a gold band around my finger. She had visited us at home and told us she was pregnant. My mother and father were ecstatic, and I was relieved that her past thoughts of going to Africa would not now come to pass. She would still be living in Leicester, and I'd be able to visit her. Alas, her husband, Richard, still eager to go to Africa, had put the wheels in motion, and his company was ready for him to go to Lagos, Nigeria. He insisted that Pauline stay in England to have the baby, since Africa was too much of a third world country, and he had no idea what their hospitals were like. He feared that native women probably gave birth to their children in the middle of the jungle. At least Pauline had mother and me. We accompanied Pauline to the clinic every month. In fact, it was one of these occasions that I was once again reminded that my mother really did not like me. On the bus, she was talking to a lady sitting in the seat in front of her. Pauline sat beside her. I was in the seat behind. I heard my mother say to the lady in front, "Yes, this is my daughter Pauline. She's the sweet one." Not like the one sitting back there. The remark left me with another scar that never went away. I had completed my secretarial training at Pittman Secretarial School in the fall of 1954 and was hired by Services Watch Company to work in the secretarial pool. It was my second day there, and I was extremely nervous sitting in front of Mr. Babbitt with my writing pad in my lap and my pencil poised. He was a thin, pale-skinned man with a goatee. The girl sitting next to me had labelled him Babbitt the Scrappit. This man apparently scrapped most of the letters he dictated if it was a reply to a customer complaint. He dictated the first letter so quickly, I thought I would never keep up, but I soon got used to his pace. It was when I realised that some of the verbiage he used in his letters was not very polite, especially to unhappy customers. I made the mistake of changing the word to read a little more kindly in every one of his letters. One afternoon, just before I was ready to go home, Mr. Babbitt called me into his office. I knew something was wrong because he hadn't given me the letters back I'd handed to him hours ago for his signature. As the newest girl in the typing pool, it was my job to take the letters to the post office after work. With his elbows on his desk, rubbing a pencil in his hands, Mr. Babbitt smiled up at me as I stood by the door. "You know, dear, we are very busy downstairs in the manufacturing plant. Would you mind helping out there just for a few days?" I must have looked shocked because he reiterated, "Just for a few days, dear." "Well, I stammered. I'm a secretary. I spent a year at night school learning shorthand and typing. I don't want to work assembling watches." He placed the pencil on the ink blotter pad, stood up and pushed his chair against the desk. He straightened his jacket, then turned and stared at me for just a moment before he said, "Right then, young lady, find yourself another job. You're fired." I didn't cry, but my mouth dropped open. I could not believe my ears. I stood motionless for a few minutes before I turned and walked out the door in a trance. I heard his loud voice. "Nobody but nobody knows about customers better than me, or changes my words." It was a rude awakening for me to know that not everyone was going to like me, or accept my corrections to their letters. I caught the bus on the corner and sat looking out the window, but not seeing anything. What now? I didn't tell my parents. They had told me over and over I should never leave one job until I had secured another. Any lapse in my room and board money would be a hardship for the family. I went to my friend's house and used her typewriter to write a new resume. Time was of the essence. I caught the early bus to the city the next day without breakfast, something I usually would never do. When the bus arrived at the town centre, I felt a bit light-headed and decided a cup of tea and a sticky bun at the cafe in the new department store, Rushkin and Thurman, would ease my hunger. The terrible thought that I might be unemployed for a long time hung over me like a black cloud. On the way through the dress department on the ground floor, I bent down to inspect a gorgeous ballroom dress on a mannequin. Unfortunately, a very tall man came around the corner and almost fell right over me. The folder he was holding went flying. Papers drifted everywhere. As I scrambled to pick up the papers, I mumbled my apologies. "No problem," he said politely. I ordered a cup of tea in the cafe upstairs and sat there thinking about my options. What would I do next? Where could I go? The tall man with his folder came in and sat at a nearby table. I watched him running his fingers through his already tousled hair as he sorted through the papers. He wrote something on each sheet and shook his head. He was obviously very frustrated at what he was reading. The waitress, an older woman very plump and pretty, smiled at the man as she set a cup of something in front of him.
"Having trouble with your secretary again, Lionel?" she asked.
"Claudia, I am going out of my mind. Stella is a nice girl, but, oh dear, her typing leaves a lot to be desired."
My heart started to pound as I rose from my seat and went to his table.
"Pardon me," I said. I'm a secretary. Can I help?"
He sat back and squinted at me. His face broke into a grin.
"You are eavesdropping."
"Yes," I said, feeling my face flush. "I'm looking for a position in this company."
"Well, do sit down. Let's talk about it."
I got the job. I was told that I was to be at the store at 8:30 a.m. and be ready when the store opened at 9. I didn't tell my parents until I had been there a week. It was a very interesting job at Rushkin and Thurman. It was a department store that sold everything from fine ladies' wear to haberdashery. Carpet was on all the floors, except for the cafe on the third floor, and it was all very plush, with glass countertops and beautifully displayed windows, changed each month by a professional interior decorator. I caught the early bus to and from work outside the Granby Halls, which was used for musical events as a dance hall. It had a prime location right in the centre of town near the clock tower. In the evenings, as I waited for the bus, the rhythmic sounds of ballroom dance music coming from the open window made me tap my feet. I'd always loved dancing around the living room when no one was at home, imagining I was on the stage. But I had never learned ballroom dancing, and since Colin had never been one to socialise at the Palais de Danse, I hadn't thought about lessons. But one evening, instead of getting on the 6 o'clock bus, I went inside to listen to the music. The dance studio was in the process of lessons for a waltz, and just as I was about to sit down to watch, a man swept me up and spun me around in an amazing sequence of steps. It seemed magical to me that I could be led around and keep in time with the rhythmic 1, 2, 3 of the waltz, just like that. I was hooked and spent the rest of the evening learning to dance. The one evening a week turned into 3. There were single men and women, all eager to learn, and it was something I looked forward to. Colin was now working for the engineering company in London. His apprenticeship was completed, and he was hoping to be employed later on in Leicester, so he could be closer to me and his parents. But it seemed to me he was enjoying his work and London far more than me. The teacher at the dance school partnered me with Kevin Walker, a tall, sharp-featured man who took dance lessons very seriously. He was a good dancer, a strong leader, and even though he was much taller than a dance partner of mine should have been, it seemed to work. Meeting 3 times a week gave us lots of time to talk and get to know each other, and I learned he was 35 years old, unmarried, and an accountant with a large firm in the city. It became habit for him to drive me home in his old car, a Humber Super Snipe with leather interior and a very large steering wheel. The dashboard was polished mahogany. Because we spent so much time together on dance nights, it was natural to discuss our work and families. He lived with his elderly parents in one of the big houses on the London Road, in an upscale area of Leicester. When I knew where he lived, I felt a little embarrassed that he had taken me home to a council house on a large estate. I'm not sure why they call a large area of houses all alike an estate. The dictionary describes estate as a large, individually owned piece of land containing a residence, not hundreds of houses like the council estates in England. Most cities in Britain still have council estates. Originally, they were built by the city fathers to accommodate men and women who worked in the mills and factories in the late 1800s. Then, during World War II, when 4 million homes were destroyed, the government had to provide housing. Council houses and flats sprang up in almost every city throughout Britain. There was always a waiting list, and in order to qualify, you had to be married or pregnant. Houses were often the topic of conversation at home. "Why, Edward," my mother would ask, "do we have to live in this blasted estate? It's so common." My father would just shake his head. "Because we can't afford to buy a house, that's why." After the war, 77% of households in England and Wales were rented under the Rental Housing Act of 1919. Money was not available during the first 3 years of the war for anything but armaments. And afterward, we owed so much to America, banks were very limited to loan for anything related to housing. The wealthy owned their own homes and purchased other houses to rent out. Statistically, it was said that the Tories owned their own homes. Labour voters did not.
My family was considered middle class and destined to always live in rented property. Kevin drove me home one night after the dance class. I noticed the house was dark. Obviously, everyone was in bed. Not wanting to disturb my parents, since the only bathroom was upstairs next to their bedroom, I went into the kitchen to wash. We had an Ascot heater, and the water was really hot, so it was no trouble to have a strip wash standing at the sink. I was just drying myself when my brother appeared in his pajamas. "What are you up to?" I asked.
"Waiting for you."
"Why?"
"I worry about you at this time of night."
"Well, you don't need to. Kevin brings me home."
He stammered. I want you to do something for me."
"What?"
"I want you to touch me."
"Touch?"
But I shrank back from him, suddenly aware that he was exposing himself.
"Douglas, stop that. Stop that right now. You're my brother, for God's sake."
"I expect Kevin expects it, doesn't he?"
"No, he doesn't. He's not like that."
I stood my ground for a moment.
"Go back to bed, Douglas."
He reached for me.
"Oh, come on."
I pushed past him and raced upstairs, still holding the towel to my chest. I had left my blouse on the chair in the kitchen. Reaching my bedroom, I closed the door firmly behind me. I leaned against it. My heart was thumping in my ears, and I could feel myself starting to sweat. What was happening to me in my own home? It was a nightmare. But I had to keep it to myself. But I made up my mind to leave the dance early from now on, so I could be in bed before my parents. I doubted he would ever come into my bedroom. For several weeks, all seemed quiet when I arrived home. My father often retired to bed early. If my mother had been imbibing in her favorite sherry, she stayed up late, listening to radio plays or music. Television was still not popular in some families, and certainly not mine. My father was of the opinion that if we needed to be entertained, a good book was the answer. I started to worry less about Douglas and his exploits. I couldn't dwell on it day and night, although I was still wary of him when he was around, especially if we were alone. I daren't discuss it with anyone, not even Colin. I decided as long as it never happened again, it would be just my secret and best forgotten, although something like that is not easily forgotten. I realize now how naive I was at that time in my life. Although I had heard that one of my schoolmates had become pregnant after she'd been raped by her cousin, it all had seemed so bizarre, so far away. That poor girl had done herself in when she tried to abort the baby.
With a knitting needle?
But that couldn't happen to me, I figured. That poor girl lived on a street that was known for thugs and bad people. Things like that happened there, I reasoned. It would surely never happen to me. Not to anyone living on Over Park Avenue. Surely not.
This is the end of episode 6. Please tune in next week to episode 7. Thank you for listening.
If you enjoyed this program and want to hear more like it, consider supporting Curry Coast Community Radio and help us get on the air. For more information, go to our website, kciw.org. Thank you for listening.